Well, hello. Wasn't sure whether to say good morning or good afternoon, so hello, old work. I enjoy studying words. Words can be a lot of fun. See where they come from, what they mean, and origins and such. There's one word that really catches my attention, politics. Very interesting word. It's got two syllables in it. Poly and ticks. Poly means many. And ticks are blood-sucking creatures. Well, it's interesting how Americans do love our politics, and particularly poking fun, making fun of our politicians. And there's good reason for it. They do a lot of, they make a lot of mistakes. We could call it mistakes and being generous with them, but they, in short, they just do a lot of dumb things. So after a while, after looking at government for so long, you can begin, we might ask the question, well, what kind of government is really good? It seems like they all have problems. What do we really need for a government? What would best serve our purpose? So let's look into this question and see just what kind of government we really need to serve us, to help us to grow to the way our Creator wants us to grow, to perfection and completeness. For to begin with, let's look at one of the earliest rebellions in history. Please turn to Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. This occurred in about the year 1030 BC, plus or minus a few years. Samuel was about 54 years old at that time. Rome was just getting started. Their people were starting to accumulate in that area where Rome now stands. And Egypt was declining after the exodus of the Hebrews, the Israelites. Egypt began its great decline. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Samuel was getting old. He had appointed his sons the job of judging and teaching and leading the Israelite people. Down in verse 4, then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make for us a king to judge us like all the other nations. Well, what they were complaining about is Samuel's sons, the priest of that time, were ripping them off. To put it in the vernacular, they were just ripping them off, stealing from them, taking advantage of them, not serving as a priest should serve. But the thing really displeased Samuel when they said it. Give us a king to judge us. Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people, all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. So there was probably the most significant rebellion in the history of mankind, a bloodless rebellion. They said, we don't want you anymore, we want a king. And the one who had been ruling over them said, okay, you can have a king. But I'll bet he smiled and he said, but I reserve the right to appoint the king. according to all the works which they have done, since the day that I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing also to you. Now, therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. Oh, this is interesting and important right here where it says, show them the behavior. In another translation of this, it points out, tell them the rights of the king. Well, these are not rights by any means. Maybe I'll remember to get into that more later, but they're not rights of the king, they're the behavior of the king. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people and asked So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. And he goes on down here talking, explaining all the things that the king will do. He will, in verse 11, this will be the behavior. He will take your sons and appoint them for his chariots and his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. In other words, he's going to establish a draft. He's not going to invite the sons to come and lead his horsemen and stand in his army. He's going to tell them. They will have to come. You can't refuse when a king tells you what to do. He will appoint captains over thousands, captains over fifties, and set some to plow his ground, reap his harvest, and some to make weapons and weapons of war and equipment for the chariots. He's going to have a standing army. Before this, the people didn't have to worry about a standing army. There was no standing army. But now they're going to have their own king, what they asked for, and give up their sons. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields and the vineyards and olive groves and give them to his servants. In other words, the king is ignoring property rights. He's taking for his own use what belongs to the people. He will take a tenth of their grain and their vintage and give it to his officers and servants. He will take their men servants and your maid servants and your finest young men and their donkeys and put them to his work. Again, it's not voluntary. It could be in some situations, but generally, when a king orders something, states something to do this, it is to be done. Not to be discussed, to be done. You will cry out in that day because your king, the king you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel and said, but no, we will have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. There they were looking for security before liberty. So this is a very great warning at a time of magnificent, monumental significance in mankind's history when they reject the rulership of the Creator and they want their own king. Well, since that time, a lot has changed. The kings have grown in their experience, they've grown in their power, they've grown in what they can demand, command, whatever they wish. So let's take a look at some of this progress and see what has happened and perhaps how it affects us today. I'm going to give you several definitions, and all of these are from my Webster Collegiate Dictionary. There are different types of governments. Monarchs, dictators, oligarchies, feudalism, democracy, republics, constitutional republics. I'll go into some of these and point out generally how they operate. The monarch is a single sole ruler of a state, the hereditary head of the state, perhaps a king or a queen or etc. A dictator. In Rome, a magistrate with supreme authority was appointed in times of emergency. In other times, not necessarily in Rome, a ruler, it means a dictator is a ruler with absolute power and authority, especially one who exercises it tyrannically. Here's the odd word, oligarchy. A form of government in which the ruling power belongs to a few people. Now, this is not an uncommon practice. Until the end of its existence, just recently, there was the Soviet Union, the USSR, which was an oligarchy. The oligarchy was called the Politburo, and it was represented, or the spokesman for the oligarchy was the premier. Another one type of government, which we don't see much of today, but I fear we might before long, is feudalism. It usually had a king, nobles, and serfs, and various craftsmen in between the nobles and the serfs. And feudalism is a political and social system in medieval Europe in which land was worked by the serfs who were bound to the land. They didn't own it, but they could not leave it. It was held by the vassals, the knights and the lesser princes and such, in exchange for military and other services given to the overlords. And the knights and the vassals and the princes and all were subject to the king. The king owned everything. The king's word was it, as long as he had the power to enforce it. Even for the king had so much power that if a knight happened to be in court serving the king and the knight needed to go back to his estate, he would have to ask the king's permission. If he left without getting the king's permission, he may never be allowed in the king's court again, or he may be demoted from his position. There are all kinds of different experimentations with power. One that we are more familiar with is the word democracy. It's not the sweet type of government that we often think it is. It comes from the Greek word demokratia. Demo, of course, means the people. Kratia is to rule. It's a government in which the people hold the ruling power. It's the rule by the ruled, the rule by majority. Well, that's okay as long as you're in the majority. When you're in the minority, you can suffer terrible consequences. It's kind of like a government of three, where two are wolves and one is a sheep, and they're going to vote on what's for supper tonight. Our founding fathers were so aware of the dangers of democracy, they did everything they could to prevent our government from becoming a democracy. So they worked with the concept of a republic. A republic is a state or a nation in which the supreme power rests in the citizens entitled to vote. Case of that is what I already mentioned, the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So each of those little republics that made up the great Soviet country were republics. Now we have what we call a constitutional republic, a republic that is controlled by a constitution, supposedly. The laws of the Constitution, all the laws in the Constitution, were written for the control of the government. They were not written for the control of the people. Some of the amendments that were added. I think there's about 28 amendments, is that correct? 26 or 28, one or the other. But most of them, the first 10, were for protecting the people, not for putting laws upon the people. So all of these forms of governments, though they have different definitions, they have different sounding objectives, they're all pretty common. They want to rule the people. And in some situations, it can be very good. In the rare situations where the people are blessed with what they call an enlightened despot, a ruler, could be a dictator, but he's enlightened, he has the well-being of the people in their mind. This is what he wants for the people. But for the most part, after they get established in that position, they see what they have, they see what the people have, and it comes down to, I see what you have, and I want it. I need it for control, for the advancement of my well-being and political well-being and power, to maintain my power. So in common with all of these, the governments generally want ownership, control of property, control of means of production, mines, properties, farms, energy production, transportation, communication. If you've traveled to many other countries, you've probably seen that most of the trains, the newspapers, telephones are owned by the government. They control them. Almost all the rulers want the control of the economy. Now, I'm going to get back to the Bible in this. I'm not straying from the purpose. This is biblical in purpose. So, I said all the rulers eventually want control of the economy. There are different approaches. It boils down to three or four basic approaches. Socialism, communism, fascism, and free market. There may have been other methods, but they're generally throughout history, this is what has been practiced on man by their governments as a result of this rebellion against God's government. This is what it comes down to. In the socialism situation, the government wants to gently progress from private ownership into government ownership of means of production and distribution of product. In communism, the ruling class wants to do it more rapidly by revolution and force. They want to move rapidly from private ownership into government ownership and distribution of product. In fascism, it's a little different. They don't try to take over everything. But the people are allowed to own their property, but the government wants to control it all. We will control it all and let the people have what we think they need. And the fourth, the least popular of all, is the free market. It's the common enemy to all of the above. The free market is the type where people can buy and sell as they wish without restrictions placed on them by the government. Now, there's biblical basis for a free market. It starts out very early in the Bible. It's not used by that name, but let's look at Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3 and see some early beginnings of the concept of the free market. Chapter 3, verse 17. After they had sinned against God, God is telling them the results of what they did. in verse 17. Then to Adam he said, the Creator, whose Hebrew name is Yahweh, says to Adam, because you have heeded the voice of your wife and eaten of the tree which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it, cursed is the ground for your sake. Now, it's important to realize here that the ground is cursed. Not Adam is cursed, but the ground is cursed. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. And you shall eat of the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. So here God is telling Adam that God is no longer going to provide all the food, all the blessings that he gave him when he was in the garden. It's now up to you, Adam. You have to go out and provide for yourself. No longer will I do it. So, here, mankind is instructed to provide for himself. Go out. Now, in that situation, they were very agricultural. In the situation today, very few people are involved in agriculture, but the same principle applies, whether you're involved in making computer chips, race cars, whatever, parachutes, driving a bus, you still have to provide for your own well-being. And this is contrary to the types of economies that the other governments have been trying to enforce ever since they took over in this great rebellion. They've been trying to enforce other types of concepts. And even before Genesis 13, before the time of Adam, another thing was set in place whereby it facilitates the working of a free market. Let's look at Exodus 20, verse 15. You're familiar with that. Exodus 20, verse 15. Very simple piece of instruction here. You shall not steal. Well, if all the governments of the world followed that piece of instruction, if all the people of the world followed that piece of instruction, life would be radically different. Radically different. So the common enemy of all of these other means of economic operations that governments enforce is the following in the instructions of God. The Creator, which created all that is, also created all the laws that work throughout the universe that have always worked as long as the universe has been here and always will work. So that's the nature of the God that they rebelled against. So what can we learn from all of this? What does it mean to us? Let's look back at Samuel. Chapter 8, 1 Samuel chapter 8. First Samuel chapter 8. Well, we see that there were an unhappy people. They had a problem, and they didn't know how to deal with it. And they chose to deal with it. Well, as I mentioned to you before, the priests were ripping them off. They were stealing from them. Just about, many of the sins, regardless of what you call it, is some form of stealing. Whether you actually go out and take somebody's car, you take their wife, or whatever you can imagine, take their life. You're taking something from somebody else. So it's very basically based in stealing. In the vernacular, again, They made the stupidest choice they could make. They had a very serious problem, and to overcome this problem, they chose a king. And that's jumping from the frying pan into the fire. That was a very foolish decision. Now they got ripped off big time. And what they were looking for is security. They wanted security. Benjamin Franklin had something to say about that. Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. And that's what they got. Neither liberty nor safety, because they rebelled from the one that was ruling over them, the Creator. Now, I was really hesitant to use this term, which describes his type of government, because it is generally really laughed at in the world today. But that's the way it is. Man's wisdom is foolishness to God. But just the other day, I ran across in Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary about the scripture, Samuel chapter 8. And it points out that the Creator God was their ruler. He was had his type of government was that of a theocracy. Nobody in the world today, well, almost nobody in the world today, would choose to live under a theocracy. They'd think, oh, that's the craziest thing in the world. Because of, again, because of all the lying and deception that has prevailed in the world. Well, they got a human government. And for many years, it has progressed and it has been practiced and it has degenerated to become something really bad. We can see that governments now kill millions of their own people. And what do we call him? The Great, like Alexander the Great. He's great because of all the people he killed. Why don't they call him Alexander the Scumbag? That would be more appropriate. Alexander the Murderer. Well, they gave up government of the Creator, the King and the Lawgiver. The ultimate ruler. He does not rule by whimsical laws. He doesn't just make up a law on the spot. Before he created anything, he made all the laws, all the rules, all the instructions by which mankind is to live. And then early on, he made it clear to mankind what those instructions are and how to live by them. The Creator rules by logic. He rules logically. All of his rulings, all of his instructions are what produce well-being and health and growth and development for mankind. Well, there's good news. After all the bad news, let's turn to Psalm chapter 103. Psalm chapter 103. 103:19. The Lord has established his throne in heaven, and his kingdom rules over all. Whether people realize it or not, he is still the theocratic ruler that he always has been. All the laws that he made are still in existence. We know that no law has been negated, no law has been changed. They all exist as they did when he made them. And all of the problems that people are experiencing today are the consequences of ignoring those laws. Just if you choose to ignore the law of gravity, you'll suffer the consequences. It might be quickly, and it might be further down the road. But you will suffer the consequences. That's just the way it works. We can't get around it. Well, few have been aware of or appreciated or enjoyed the rulership of our Creator. Most would rather not even think about it or discuss it or hear of it. Man's attempt at ruling is approaching its end, fortunately. No more will there be standing armies. No more will there be great murders on national scales and histories of making history by killing millions of your own people. But the time will come when all will appreciate and enjoy the rule of the Creator. And he said to Israel, as he said to Israel in Exodus chapter 6, one last verse, Exodus chapter 6. More good news. This is really good news. Chapter 6, verse 7. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. That is an immensely merciful and kind and loving thing that our Creator is going to do and has done with Israel. But he will do the same for all of those who accept his rule and follow his instructions. The time is coming when man's disastrous attempt to govern will come to an end over all the earth. And all the earth can enjoy the peace and well-being and abundance and perfection of the Creator's rule. And the wonderful thing that we see every year is the holy days that picture the process of changing from man's rule to God's rule.